and welcome to the 20th episode of Nations of Charlemagne, the Spanish Succession. Now, you're probably wondering why I'm talking about Spain in a history series which is dedicated to Italian, French, and German history. Well, one can't really talk about this period in history, so the turn of the 18th century, without talking about the demise of the Habsburg dynasty, the demise of the House of Burgundy, the Western branch, the Spanish branch of the Habsburg dynasty, and the massive ramifications this is going to have for the balance of power in Europe, and also how this is going to link into our conversation next week when we talk about German dualism and the rise of Prussia, beginning with the Austrian War of Succession. When I'm talking about the Spanish Succession, I do want to keep it within this context of European history. A lot of histories of the Spanish Succession tend to deal with the subject from the British perspective. And really, that's going to be a topic for another time. Obviously, I'm going to reference Britain and talk about Britain's role in all of this. But in terms of how this war in particular, the War of the Spanish Succession, set up the British Empire vis-a-vis the Dutch, etc., that'll have to wait for another time. In this conversation, I really want to get at the unraveling of the Habsburg Empire, the reconsolidation of said empire into what would later become known as the Habsburg monarchy, and what the effects of this situation is going to have on the history of Italy, the history of France, and the history of Germany. So without further ado, we'll embark on this topic. Now, I have two maps here. One is the vast Spanish Empire within the within continental Europe, and the map on the right is only a token piece of the Spanish possessions across the world, because in addition to holding what we would later refer to as Latin America, sans Brazil, everything from Florida to Mexico, all the way down to Chile in the south, they also control the Philippines and various other islands. So this map isn't even a full rendering of the sheer scale of the Spanish Empire outside of Europe. But within Europe, this map is particularly useful for us because, in addition to showing the sheer scale of the Spanish Empire at its height during the 16th century, we also see the various losses of territory, which is going to talk about this idea of what I've termed Habsburg diminution, this idea of Habsburg decline. Of course, there have been revisionist historians coming back and saying, no, this wasn't a period of decline, rather the 17th century Spanish Empire is rather similar to that of the 16th century Spanish Empire, dealing with the same problems, the excessive reliance on bullion, minerals, silver, gold from the New World, etc., the relative backwardness of the Spanish economy compared to that of France, let alone the Netherlands at this time, which would replace, you know, Spain as the main naval and mercantile empire. Nevertheless, I feel that these revisions go a little bit too far. And when we refer to, for example, the reign of Charles II, the Bewitched, I think it is useful to use the word decline, not least when talking about the actual loss of territory. So in 1609, the Netherlands has already essentially achieved its independence, albeit this won't be recognized for another 30 years. An independent Netherlands becomes a major naval opponent to the Spanish and begins to attack Dutch colonies. And the effect of this is that the Portuguese-Spanish Union, which was inaugurated under Philip II in 1580, is very much weakened because the Spanish are unable to preserve Portuguese colonies against the Dutch. And again, the novelty of the situation is that both the Netherlands and Portugal are nominally kingdoms of kingdoms under Spain, under Castile, during this entire time. So during the reign of Charles II's father, Charles II, of course, is the last Habsburg king of Spain, his father being Philip IV, we see the considerable loss of territory. So already we see the de facto independence of the Netherlands, and this had taken place during the reign of Philip II. During the reign of Philip IV, we see the loss of Portugal. Portugal, under the Braganza dynasty, leads a successful revolution against the Habsburgs in Madrid and becomes an independent kingdom in 1640 again. Now, what isn't mentioned on this map is in the same year, there is a considerable rebellion in Catalonia, which briefly severs its link with Madrid and joins in with France. And this will be resolved some 20 years later with the Peace of 1659, which surrenders this territory you can see here of Roussillon to France. But during the reign of Louis XIV, so this is also coinciding with the reign of Charles II, we see the loss of some key territories. So in addition to the territories around Artois, Picardy, modern-day northern France, but then constituted the southern Netherlands. We also see the loss of this little territory in eastern France called the Free Duchy of Burgundy, the French Comte, or the Freigrafschaft, or the Franco Commando, depending on what language you're using. But the significance, I think, of this territory in particular being lost is that the western branch of the House of Habsburg is called the House of Burgundy because the dynasty originated in Burgundy. The dynasty, which attempted to create a third kingdom of Burgundy under Charles the Bold, his daughter would marry Maximilian, and the family would separate with Maximilian's children by Mary of Burgundy, later on becoming the kings of Spain, and then Charles V reconstituting that division between Austria and Spain by conferring Bohemia, Hungary, and Austria onto his brother Ferdinand, who would later become Holy Roman Emperor and lead the junior branch of the House of Habsburg. But the heart of the Western Habsburgs really isn't in Spain, even though that's their center of administration. But the dynastic origins are in Burgundy. So I think it's rather symbolic that in 1678, the Habsburgs do lose this territory of Burgundy, therefore severing that Burgundian link from the Spanish House of Burgundy forever, in terms of, indicating some sort of broad sense of decline. But continuing on from last week's theme on French absolutism and tying this in to the themes of that lecture and discussion I had with Columba, I have a short excerpt here from a recent book, The Habsburgs by Martin Rady. It's a short extract, it's just one short chapter, but it does a good job of explaining the status of the internal situation, the dynastic situation in Spain around the same time, the same time frame we're talking about with the previous lecture on France. And just for reference going forward, this lecture is going to conclude around the year 1740. So we're starting a little bit later and we're ending a little bit later. And here is this excerpt. During the 16th century, monarchs throughout Europe became increasingly hidden and confined from public view. This partly arose from the adoption of high etiquette pioneered at the Burgundian court, which was necessarily imposed to give rulers relief from their importunate subjects. Instead of invading the king's bedroom, and as one French king complained, borrowing his clothes, courtiers and others were now spatially distanced from the ruler and their access to him restricted. Henceforth, proximity to the king's person depended on status, and was coveted into a was converted into a mark of esteem. So for a plate of food to reach the ruler, it might have to go through as many as 24 separate pairs of hands, with each succeeding bearer being entitled to approach the sovereign just a little bit more closely than the one before. As Eugene of Savoy, and Eugene of Savoy is a major protagonist we're going to get into later, dryly observed, the physical distancing of the ruler had at least the merit of keeping waitresses beyond the royal grasp. But the distancing of the monarch also arose from the idea that his office was divinely ordained, and that he should assume a corresponding remoteness. In imitation of God, he was, in one contemporary description, perfect, unchanging in majesty, omnipresent, and so incomprehensible that none can reach his secrets. From the 1580s, the Habsburg kings of Spain were conventionally addressed as Signor or Lord, which was precisely how one addressed the Almighty in prayer. The monarch was, moreover, not only godlike, but also an embodiment of the sun, and it was as the Sun King that Philip IV was known well before Louis XIV appropriated that title. The Spanish king's court and palace were accordingly arranged like a universe, like the universe, on principles of celestial harmony and mechanical predictability, with each minor sphere revolving round to its ordained place in the heavenly hierarchy. Within this scheme, the king's activities were also measured and predetermined, so much so that he moved according to one visiting French nobleman with such regularity that day by day he knows exactly what he will do for the whole of his life. Burgundian court ceremony has been described as combining sacralization, distance, and discipline. But it was more complex. The 5th century Burgundian dukes valued discipline. Valued remoteness, and yet had no wish to cut off completely from their subjects. For this reason, the last of the Burgundian dukes, Charles the Bald, reserved 3 evenings a week to the hearing of petitions of poor people, much to the irritation of his attending courtiers. The formal adoption of Burgundian court practices in Spain, which took place in 1548 and was preceded by several weeks of retraining for household staff, saw the principle carried over into Spanish protocol. And of course, the Spanish court, essentially the Burgundian court under Chivray and Charles V, moves over in the 1520s. Even in the 17th century, the kings of Spain dedicated several days a week to the hearing of petitions, with the instructions given to the palace doorkeepers that no supplicant be refused entry. Bullfights, displays of horsemanship, and religious processions gave further opportunities for the king to be seen. But his appearances on these occasions were crafted so that no glimpse was given of the human being beneath the cloak of majesty. The king's movements were stiff and mannered, his face was fixed in austere solemnity, and he was preceded in silence. Even with his ministers, and while at ease in the palace, Philip IV was notoriously unyielding. He admonished his wife for laughing at a buffoon's tricks, and was both unmoved and unmoving when a minister collapsed with a stroke before him at a council meeting. As one Spanish councillor shrewdly pointed out, court etiquette had also rendered the sovereign but a ceremony. Monarchs became increasingly remote from government too. Philip II had been what is now called a micromanager, doing so much poring over and directing of details that administration felt rudderless in his absence. At the time, Philip's obsessive attention was sort of a mark of his dedication to Spain and of his commitment to just government. Philip's son, Philip III, started off by trying to emulate his father, busying himself with committees and drawing up plans for the invasion of Ireland and Africa. But when his grandiose plans came unstuck, he became lazy and diffident, entrusting his affairs to his advisers and increasingly to his valido, or confidant, the Duke of Lerma. The valido, halfway between a royal favourite and a prime minister, took care of most royal business, and in the case of Lerma, usurped his position to make a personal fortune. Even so, a valido was useful to the ruler, and not only as a workhorse. When politics failed, he could be blamed. Policies failed, rather. Valimiento, or government by valido, continued into the reign of Philip IV, being discharged by the Count Duke of Olivares, and from the mid-1640s by Don Luis Tejado. Olivares is, of course, the picture on the left here. Their mastery of government left Philip IV free to undertake the ceremonial functions of kingship, commission great works of art, and perform what he did best, which was to father illegitimate children, of whom he had no fewer than 30. In between his dalliances, Philip maintained a voluminous correspondence with the levitating abbess and mystic Mary of Jesus of Agreda, confessing his sins of the flesh and receiving advice on the conduct of policy. She urged him to take up reins of government and rule personally, dispensing with favourites. Her advice was seconded by noblemen who felt they had been left without influence. King Philip bowed to the pressure, dismissing Olivares in 1643, but he soon raised Don Luis de Haro to take Olivares' place. Now, Olivares, in mentioning this idea of velimiento, or the government by the valido, and of course the point referenced here by Reidy, the idea that when policies failed, he could be blamed. Well, of course, Olivares was responsible for Spain's particularly disastrous first few years in their war with France from 1635 until 1643, during which the Spanish lost Portugal, they lost Catalonia, and again, we're seeing the intensification and the decline of the Habsburg position during the 30 Years' War at the same time. So corresponding to this, Olivares could be dismissed in 1643, and this couldn't impugn the image of the king. Opinion at that time was convinced that kings should rule and not delegate their responsibilities. As one of Philip's advisers observed, Valimiento was the misfortune of our century, for it led to factionism, resentment, disaffection, and bankruptcy. The king had been appointed by God, and so should follow God's example by governing in his own person. The appeal to the cosmic order of the universe was typical of a broad range of monarchical literature in Spain. One such mentioned was, of course, The Monarchy of Spain by Tommaso Campanella. If you recall the discussion part of the Tridentine era, our episode dedicated to Spanish rule in Italy. As one jurist explained, the monarch was a simulacrum of God on earth, whose actions he must follow and imitate. It followed that he could not share his sovereignty with another, but should discharge an absolute royal power, poderio real absoluto. But these were the pleadings of lawyers, for the royal power was constrained both in principle and in practice. First, it was widely believed that the monarch's right to make law was limited by previous statutes and inherited traditions, the setting aside of which jeopardized the established harmony within the kingdom, which was his duty to preserve. An analogy frequently made was the similarity between royal government and a harp, the strings of which should be tightened or relaxed to produce a melodious consonance among the king's subjects. Other writers compared monarchy to a clockwork engine, which the king was tasked with keeping in running order. It was not for him to innovate, but instead to preserve and renew. From this, it followed that the king might not disregard Spain's historic parliaments, the Cortes of Castile, the Courts General of Aragon. And of course, Spain is still not a unitary state. Going back to this map here, as you can see, the two main divisions of Spain are the crown, not just the kingdom, the crown of Castile, because the crown of Castile consists of other kingdoms such as Leon and such as Granada, and the crown of Aragon. And to make things even more complicated, Sicily, you could say in the east here in Italy, was part of the crown of Aragon along with Sardinia, but Naples here was part of the crown of Castile, and this indicates the point of which these various territories were inherited and incorporated into the various domains. So, for example, Naples wasn't incorporated until the early 16th century by Ferdinand and Isabella. Although the Habsburg kings of Spain never accepted the principle that taxation should be made dependent on the crowns, remedying the complaints of the deputies, the right of the Castilian Cortes to approve tax was never called into question. Such indeed was the partnership between monarch and parliament that the king allowed his deputies to monitor royal expenditure and even to lay down precisely how it should be spent. Even in the turbulent kingdom of Aragon, government sought cooperation and not confrontation, notwithstanding the court's general's insistence on pactismo, that the Aragonese obeyed the ruler only for as long as he kept the terms of that Cortes general laid down. Certainly during the second half of the 17th century, both the Cortes and the court's general of Aragon withered, seldom being summoned. Discontinuation suited Philip IV, for it spared him the financial burden of hosting these assemblies. The cost of cushions alone for the deputy's comfort was prohibitive. But it also appealed to the cities of Castile, which resented paying salaries to the deputies when they took bribes anyway. Nonetheless, consensus building and agreement still prevailed, with the king or his valido making agreements with smaller committees, deputations, and the government of the kingdom's individual cities. The theatre may have changed, but the underlying assumptions of royal rule proceeded by way of discussion and agreement had not. It helped that the ambitions of Louis XIV reminded even the obstructive Aragonese nobles that there were other methods of rule that they might find less to their liking. And of course, this has particular pertinence in the fact that Catalonia briefly joined with France, and Louis XIV is at this precise moment trying to ram through the ratification of his edict using the principle of lite de justice, that the Parlement or the various legal structures within France had to register royal edicts, and that they were not, as we saw with the Fronde, afforded the right of accruing taxation, let alone acting as a national legislature. And of course, rather than extend the powers of the Paris Parlement, Louis XIV incorporated and created new parlements whenever he was expanding, often at Spanish expense, in the French Comte or in the Spanish Netherlands. When established methods of consultation were set aside, as under the Count Duke Olivares in the 1620s and 1630s, then disharmony was considered the natural consequence. Olivares sought to increase the tax and military contribution of the non-Castilian parts of Spain, claiming they were not paying their way. But his disregard for the established rights and procedures provoked in 1614 a rebellion in Catalonia and a secession of Portugal. Critics of his policy were not slow to point out that he had neglected the prudence and judgment of his ancestors, whom long practice had dearly bought experience had instructed, and so mistuned the harp of kingdoms and commonwealths. The fall of Olivares exposed the limits of government. The kings of Spain lacked the capacity to impose their will, for large parts of the kingdom operated outside of their control. To raise cash, rulers had over generations sold offices, exemptions for taxation, and rights to property. Most of these passed into the possession of the cities and greater or titled noblemen, who carved out large landed estates over which they exercised an almost complete territorial authority. The nobles protected the integrity of their estates by converting them into trusts, thereby avoiding the ruinous partition of landed wealth between heirs. By the 17th century, 4/5 of all land in Castile was owned by the crown, titled nobles, cities, and the church. The kingdom's free peasants were squeezed into the remainder, and over time transformed into indebted sharecropping tenants. Likewise, minor nobles, or hidalgos, were often pressed into the service of greater lords, becoming in effect their retainers. Similar conditions prevailed in the New World. The viceroys and governors in America and the Pacific held an authority that was conceived as absolute and discharged a power that was considered divine. The only ostensible difference between the viceroy and his royal master was that he might not sign proclamations as I the king, yo el rey. But although the viceroys did not have to put up with parliaments, they still had to negotiate. In cities and towns, municipal councils made up of largely hereditary office holders obstructed the viceroy's commands. When in 1609 Philip III broached the idea to institute a Cortes in Lima, the viceroy advised that it could only lead to restlessness and that having to deal with city councils was bad enough. Most of the Spanish population in the New World was squeezed into the cities. In Mexico around the year 1600, almost 60% of Europeans lived in 11 cities, each laid out in a gridiron fashion, with a central plaza and streets running at right angles. The countryside constituted the Republic of the Indians, which followed its own laws, had its own native nobility, and continued to blend Aztecs and Mayan traditions with Catholic Christianity and imported European conventions. As best they could, priests and friars protected the natives from abuse by the Republic of the Spaniards, but they could not prevent the Indians from being enlisted to serve in plantations and mines of Spanish-owned estates, or haciendas, and I do forget, apologize for my Spanish pronunciation. I can't speak Spanish at all. Where native workers were unavailable, settlers brought in African slave labor. Across large parts of the New World, haciendas constituted mini kingdoms, which functioned independently of Habsburg governors and viceroys. In Paraguay and deep in the Amazon rainforest, Jesuit missionaries also carved out their own theocratic states, fielding armies and corralling the natives into concentrated villages, the better to control and convert them. Spanish colonial society was therefore by no means homogeneous. The stress on the purity of the blood inherited from Spain was amplified in the New World. Privilege was defined by race. Only first-generation Spanish immigrants, peninsulares, and their unsullied descendants, criollos, were entitled to go to university, serve in the administration, join most guilds, and enjoy exemption from taxes. Over time, distinctions became increasingly subtle, with persons of mixed race dividing into a hierarchy of subgroups, depending on the degree of mixing and with whom, whether a native Indian or a black slave. The higher up the hierarchy, the more opportunities to make the leap of by wealth or marriage into an otherwise exclusive category of the criollo. To make sure that everyone knew their place, artists composed detailed caste portraits that contrasted the 16 mixtures thought to be possible, their different skin colours, and the impoverishment and moral decay that belonged to those whose blood was more tainted. The Habsburg New World was no less devoted to the Catholic religion than Spain, displaying the same marks of piety, but caste and race blurted observance. The conspicuous dedication to the host and virgin, which the Habsburg rulers impressed on their subjects, was performed in the New World against a backdrop of segregation in churches, parishes, and processions. Religious vocations adjusted to pigmentocracy, too. Since nunneries usually only accepted women of pure blood, a mark of social esteem was to display at home a portrait of a relative, either in a nun's habit or as she prepared to enter the novitiate, crowned with a garland of flowers. Portraits often included a coat of arms or recorded the sitter's lineage. Though an inscription at the bottom of the painting, signalling the racial integrity of their family and of their home in which their image hung. Images of crown nuns were as unreal as the representation of a dead king on his catafalque. Both, however, were intended to display a divinely ordained order, at the top of which stood a racially pure elite and the sovereign ruler, discharging an unlimited authority as God's likeness on earth. But the gulf between the image of monarchy and its reality was becoming increasingly stark. On Philip IV's death in 1665, the succession passed to his infant son, Charles II, a pitiful imbecile. Charles long surprised contemporaries by continuing to live. He left no heir, for he was plainly incapable of performing the sexual act. After 10 years of marriage, his first wife, with whom he shared a pathetic intimacy, was unable to say whether she was still a virgin. His second wife was intent mainly on plundering her husband's palaces for furniture and paintings, which she sent to her needy parents in the Rhineland. Contemporaries attributed the king's maladies to sorcery, on which account Charles was known as the bewitched, El Hechizado, and ceremonies of exorcism were performed. With the king clearly incapable of government, powers were exercised on his behalf by his widowed mother and his second wife and a succession of elidos. Unwashed and unkempt, Charles II spent his last months wandering through woods, watching magic lantern shows of a pious content, and examining the corpses of his ancestors in the vault of the Escorial Palace, a tradition which is dating back to Joanna the Mad, the mother of Charles V, who famously kept the corpse of her husband, Philip the Handsome, close with her. And of course, she was interned and dispossessed of her authority as Queen of Spain, which was handed over to her son. On the 28th of September 1700, Charles received his last rites. 3 days later, he signed off on the testament Porto Carrero brought him, gasping, "Now I am nothing." Still, he defied his doctors, only expiring after an agonizing final month. A post-mortem of the dead king disclosed a very small heart, lungs corroded, intestines putrefactive and gangrenous, 3 large stones in the kidney, a single testicle, black as coal, and his head full of water. A modern review of the medical evidence concludes that Charles suffered from a posterior hypospadias, monarchism, and an atrophic testicle. He probably had an intersexual state with ambiguous genitalia and a congenital monokidney with stones and infections. In other words, he had a single kidney and a single testicle, and his urethra excited on the underside of an undeveloped penis. The same account additionally proposes fragile X syndrome, typically leading to some mental retardation and an elongated face, which may be attributed to generations of inbreeding within the Habsburg family. And just to emphasize this, on the right here, I have Charles II's family tree. And as you should be aware, with a family tree, once you have the common ancestors, Philip and Joanna, there should really be a massive branching out. But interestingly, as you can see here, the family tree does not expand, it contracts. With the killing off, the dying of all these various cousins, and cousin by cousin marriages through every generation, until we get to the situation where Charles II is the byproduct of literally generations of cousin by cousin inbreeding, and his own father having married his niece of the Habsburg branch of the family. Hence, you know, among other sort of extreme elements which have been listed here, the continuation of the Habsburg jaw, which is already pretty pretty dominant feature in the Habsburg genes at the earliest stages of the dynasty, when inbreeding wasn't such a common issue. One of the sort of early instances of insanity in inbreeding is with the case of Dom Juan, the original Prince of Asturias, the son of Philip the Second during the 16th century. But of course, Charles II was unfortunate in the fact that he had all of these maladies confined to his single person. Interestingly enough, his cousin, who would later claim the throne, Leopold, was similarly inbred, but nevertheless was capable enough to rule. And this also should be noted that Louis XIV, as we're going to get into, was again the byproduct of inbreeding and very closely related to the Habsburg dynasty as well, through his mother and through his wife, who was also his cousin. The tragedy of Charles became a symbol for contemporaries, embodying the decline of Spanish royal power and the decay of the kingdom. The evils of the nation were seen as one with his own, and his physical afflictions likened to the king's misfortunes. A stylized lament on Charles' death in 1700 extolled the glory that the king had brought to the House of Austria and his contribution to the double empire of two worlds. But with Charles's passing, Habsburg rule in the peninsula drew to a close, and along with it, Habsburg mastery of the Americas and the Pacific Ocean. From now on, the Habsburg dominions were confined to their European possessions. Their empire of the two worlds was at an end. And of course, that's quite a damning indictment by Martin Brady. It's not quite true as of yet, because as we're going to go into, this brings about one of the worst conflicts in this period of time, in the early modern period, which of course you could refer to as a European Great War, if not a world war, because it was global in its dimensions and its ramifications. And this brings us on to the issue of the succession and coming to the idea of the contenders. Now, for ease, I've lifted this family tree from Wikipedia, which shows Charles II right in the middle, and the golden boxes indicate those who claimed the Spanish throne at one point. And as you can see, you have the French line on the one hand, on the left-hand side, and the Austrian Habsburg line on the right-hand side. Now, the issue of the succession was constantly ongoing. I mean, as commented, one of the most remarkable things about Charles II, the Bewitched, was that he did not die. One of the striking aspects of Habsburg inbreeding during the 17th century is that the Habsburgs had an incredibly high mortality rate. I think it's something like 80% of Habsburg children were unable to reach their majorities, so, you know, around the age of 13 onwards. So Charles was not expected to survive, and he inherited the throne at a very young age, at the age of 4, from his father Philip IV, who also, you know, sired 30 illegitimate children. But despite the abundance of bastards in the Habsburg camp, of course, none of them could ever feasibly claim the throne of Spain. So the inbred 4-year-old Charles was thus made king and not expected to survive, and thus the issue of the succession was at the forefront of much policy deliberation for the next 40 years. And of course, this is coming at a time where in 1661, the year Charles is born, Louis XIV will, as you know, if you've watched the previous content, is now embarking upon his phase of personal rule. So at a time where Spain has an incompetent monarch, France now has the most competent king possibly ever in its entire history, rivaling that of Philip IV, rivaling that of Philip Augustus, Louis IX, what have you. And Spain is shackled with this this tragic figure of Charles II. So with the issue looming over the Spanish succession, now comes the point, you know, who was eligible to become King of Spain? Well, as people know, going back to this graph here, even though the Spanish inheritance from Charles V onwards was through male primogeniture, male preference primogeniture, in this way it's very similar to England. Of course, the crown of Castile had been inherited by Isabella and then passed on to her daughter Joanna. So unlike what we see in France or in the Holy Roman Empire, which has obviously, you know, male absolute succession in the form of the Salic law, Spain permits female succession, matrilineal succession. So looking at this graph we have here, the closest candidates were obviously from the Houses of France, the House of Bourbon, and the Habsburg branch of the family, the junior branch in Austria, through Charles's two sisters, Mary Theresa and Margaret Theresa, respectively. The Spanish court then was divided off into factions, though the leading women in the Spanish court, which Rady has already alluded to, the Queen Mother Mariana of Austria and the Queen Maria Anna, were both in the Austrian camp. Moreover, as Spain would no doubt now be inherited from a foreign king, i.e. inherited from without, not by a domestic noble or someone already residing in Spain, the inheritance of Spain now became a major bone of contention for the diplomatic situation in Europe. So any candidate for the Spanish throne now inevitably needed foreign backing. And just for instance, to show how much of an ongoing issue this was, just after the restoration of Charles II, so Charles II is restored in, this is England, he is restored in 1660. He supports the succession of the French, of a French candidate. It would perhaps at this time be Louis le Grand Dauphin, who is the son of Louis XIV and has a very good claim to the Spanish to the Spanish crown. But when we have the Glorious Revolution, this changes and the English switch their support from the Grand Dauphin to Leopold. When, and of course this is part of the Grand Alliance, which was alluded to earlier, where they switch their support from France to Austria. As Charles survived longer than anyone had anticipated, the issue of the succession was thus deferred until the turn of the 18th century. Now, to give a little bit of backstory on these figures here, we've already gone into Louis XIV, so I only mention him briefly. But Leopold became Holy Roman Emperor in, when was it, 1657, inheriting it from his father Ferdinand III, and he was the grandson of Ferdinand II, who had fought the 30 Years' War. And he was the arch rival and also the cousin of Louis XIV. And as we have already seen with the incapacitated nature of Charles II, despite being the junior Habsburg in the relationship, even though Spain holds a diminished title, that of king compared to emperor of the Austrian branch, the Spanish have more resources and they are considered essentially the core, the economic and military core to holding up Habsburg power, because the situation in Austria has been in flux for the last century. It's only recently, post the Battle of White Mountain, that areas such as Bohemia have actually started becoming reliable allies to the Habsburg crown. And of course, this is a time where the Ottomans are reconsolidating under the Kapulu dynasty, and they are making inroads again into Austria, and their Hungarian possessions in Slovakia, Transylvania, Croatia, and the Transdubia. And unfortunately for Leopold, he had no greater success in dealing with the French expansion either. So once Louis XIV begins to expand into the empire with the Spanish Wars of Devolution, even with the support of Spain, Denmark, the United Provinces, and Brandenburg during the Dutch War, Leopold continually loses territory at the expense of Louis XIV. In 1683, we have the height of the so-called Chamber of Reunions, whereby Louis XIV is contriving various claims on the lands on the left bank of the Rhine, Belgium, which is at this point the Spanish Netherlands. And in the same year, we have the Ottoman attack on Vienna. And this could have potentially ended the Habsburg dynasty in the East, in the Holy Roman Empire. And what actually transpired was their greatest victory, the greatest victory of the Austrian branch of the Habsburg dynasty in what would now become known as the Great Turkish War. The Austrians, together with their Holy League allies, these included the Bavarians, but mainly it included the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, destroyed the armies of Kara Mustafa Pasha, pushing the Ottomans out of the lands of Hungary, the lands of St. Stephen, under their brilliant commander, Prince Eugene of Savoy. And this greater victory at Vienna in 1683 was confirmed by the Battle of Zenta in 1697. And all of these gains were confirmed at the Treaty of Karlowitz, reversing nearly two centuries of Ottoman gains in Europe, just to emphasize how much of a great victory this was for the Austrians. And at the same time, Louis XIV is coming under attack from the Grand Alliance in the West after the Glorious Revolution. And this alliance unmade the various French conquests of the previous decade on the left bank of the Rhine. With Austria's war against France over in 1697 and the Ottoman War over in 1699, the balance of power in Europe had shifted briefly in the Habsburgs' favour. And by the Habsburgs, of course, I'm referring to the Austrian Habsburgs, because there is no heir to the Spanish branch of the family as of yet. And this is the fact that Leopold, despite his victories against the Ottomans and despite his victories against France, the treaty which ends the so-called 9 Years' War against France in 1697, the Treaty of Ryswick, doesn't deal explicitly with the idea of the Spanish succession. So as now Charles is entering into his late 30s, the issue of the Spanish succession was still unresolved, and historians in hindsight have therefore claimed that the 4 years between 1697 and 1701 was but a truce in that conflict, but I don't take that view. I don't take that view partly because it wasn't clear who was going to inherit at this time, and whether the conflict would have been able to be resolved peacefully, as we'll go into all the possible candidates now. Now, Louis was very ambitious, and he wanted his son, the Grand Dauphin, who never became King of France, the Grand Dauphin Louis, to become King of Spain. And he had a claim through his mother, Louis XIV's wife, who was therefore the Grand Dauphin, was the nephew of Charles II. But given that the Grand Dauphin was expected to inherit France from Louis XIV at some point, that would have meant that France and Spain would have entered into a personal union. And such a colossal power hadn't been seen since the reign of Charles V. Arguably, the Spanish inheritance combined with France was more powerful than the empire of Charles V. So in so doing, it would have virtually guaranteed war, anything to prevent that happening. And this would have been, war either from the Spanish, but also including the Dutch, the English, and the Austrians. And given his recent reverse in fortunes in the Nine Years' War, the incredible Austrian victory at against the Ottomans, Louis began to negotiate his rights in Spain with the aim of avoiding another conflict. And the first of these so-called compromise candidates is the young figure we have in the centre here, the Bavarian candidacy. Leopold had married Charles's full sister and closest relative, Margaret Theresa, whose daughter had in turn married the Elector of Bavaria, Maximilian Emmanuel, an ambitious and capable military commander, the so-called Blue Prince, or the Blue Elector, who was anxious to gain territories for the House of Wittelsbach. And this is playing into another element, which we have seen here, which is this, not just the rivalry between the House of France and the House of Habsburg, but also the rivalry between the House of Wittelsbach, the Bavarian branch, and the House of Habsburg as well. And potentially this could have been the great rise of the Bavarian dynasty had this all played well for the ambitious and capable Maximilian Emmanuel, but as we're going to go into, it was not meant to be. In 1692, at the height of both the Turkish and Nine Years' War, the niece, the full-blooded niece of Charles II and the Elector of Bavaria, produced a son, Joseph Ferdinand, therefore making him Charles's closest male relative. And of course, he has an advantage over the French claimants because Mary Theresa, the wife of Louis XIV, is only a half sister, not a full sister of the king. Rather than negotiate with Leopold, Louis bypassed the emperor by conducting negotiations on the succession with the Dutch and the English in hope of wooing them to the French side. And of course, this is Louis using a classic example of trying to divide the enemies by playing them off against each other. And he achieves this in 1698 when the two sides, so the Netherlands and England on the one hand and France on the other, negotiating the Treaty of Hague, which conferred the two Sicilies. So I'll bring this map up for everyone to gauge at. The two Sicilies, of course, Naples here and Sicily here, will be given to France. And this is harkening back to a very old episode, if you remember, the Italian Wars over the Neapolitan succession, or the succession of Anjou, which had been evoked by Charles VIII some 200 years before. Austria will be compensated with Lombardy. So Lombardy is currently part of the Spanish inheritance, but it is a Habsburg domain, and this will be ceded over to the Austrian Habsburgs. Charles II would not countenance, and again, the Netherlands itself, the Spanish Netherlands itself, and Spain itself, and the empire, most importantly, would be inherited by a Wittelsbach, would be inherited by Joseph Ferdinand of Bavaria. Charles II of Spain, however, would not countenance the division of his territory, which he held inviolable. Instead, rather than accept the Treaty of Hague, Charles II agreed that Joseph Ferdinand should be his heir, but that he should inherit the entire empire. So again, this would have worked perfectly for the ambitions of Bavaria, in that the Elector of Bavaria would have his son ruling over the entire Spanish inheritance, including the Spanish Empire and the New World. But as we're going to see, the issue of giving the Spanish inheritance over to one single dynast in any such situation would have provoked conflict due to the unfolding, the unraveling of this great strategically integrated empire of the Habsburgs, upon which the Holy Roman Empire, led by Austria, was incredibly dependent on the Spanish possessions. So, say for example, if the Netherlands, the modern day Belgium, excepting Liège and Lombardy, suddenly became allied or part of a hostile power to Austria, this would have precipitated war, regardless of the rights or who was the claimant in this period. This first compromise obviously ended because, as you can see here, the young prince died in 1699 at the age of 7. He died of smallpox, and thus the ambitions of the House of Wittelsbach for the entire Spanish inheritance were confounded, and the French were forced to come up with a second partition treaty, the Treaty of London. The candidate to replace the Bavarian prince was now the Archduke Charles, the figure on the right here, Leopold's second son. And Leopold, of course, being the Holy Roman Emperor. The British thinking here was to avoid an Austro-Spanish union like that of Charles V by recreating the Spanish and Austrian branches of the House of Habsburg. So the first son of Leopold, Joseph, would become Holy Roman Emperor, and the second son, Charles, would become King of Spain and all of Spain's associated territories. With the Habsburg on the throne of Spain and the Netherlands, France would be awarded the further territory of Lombardy. Thus, as part of this partition treaty, France would have gained all of the direct Spanish territories in Italy at this point. So again, we're almost recreating the conditions for the Italian wars fought during the late 15th and first half of the 16th century. And as thoroughly predictable, Charles II of Spain, upon hearing this, reacts against this by saying, "I will not divide my territories. Rather, I shall recognize now the Archduke Charles as my sole heir." And as the Spanish and the Austrians would not consent to the partition, i.e., giving France, Naples, Sicily, and Lombardy, now that you have a Spanish candidate who's been recognized by the King of Spain, or sorry, an Austrian candidate being recognized as the King of Spain as the new heir, France now potentially risked losing everything, because this partition treaty had not been recognized by Spain, had not been recognized by Austria. It was solely dependent on France going above both of those powers and relying on the goodwill of his former arch enemy, William of Orange, who was King William III of England and the Stadtholder of the Netherlands. So it became a sort of major point of French national security. And of course, France's own sort of dynastic ambitions to try and compel the King of Spain to instead push for the candidacy of Philip of Anjou, the figure on the left. And the French achieved this by bribing various members of the court. I've already indicated that there was already a French faction at the court in Spain ready to advance France's interests. And the reason Philip of Anjou was selected was because he was the second son of the Grand Dauphin, and therefore he was not expected to inherit the Kingdom of France. Had there been a king, essentially, like the Grand Dauphin becoming King of Spain, again, it could have precipitated this general sort of coalition against France based on the idea that they were entering into a personal union. So now French thinking was moving beyond that, and to try and prevent an escalation of conflict, the compromise was therefore on essentially a division between Bourbon territories. There would be a Bourbon House of Spain, and there would be a Bourbon House of France. The influence of Cardinal de Portocarrero, and of course, Portocarrero was influenced. It was a reference by Ready earlier as the decisive factor in convincing the king, rather compelling the king, who is now moribund on his bed, to change his will yet again to leave the entire Spanish inheritance to Philip of Anjou. And at this point, Charles finally dies, and Philip was proclaimed King of Spain at the Palace of Versailles. Now, it was hoped, again, that by leaving the throne to Philip rather than the Grand Dauphin Louis, who would have been, the closest heir in the House of France, that such a conflict could be avoided. Yet had France, you know, not intervened at all, had France simply let the Archduke Charles take over the throne of Spain, it is likely that France would have squandered, you know, an opportunity for such a major realignment in European politics to suit her interests. And again, this is coming out of French desperation for a new ally after their recent history of encirclement during the 9 Years' War, in which every major power of Europe was essentially opposed to them. So it therefore suited French interests, the fact that the Spanish didn't want to divide up their territory, they didn't want to partition that territory. The French were originally prepared to accept a non-French candidate on the throne in return for territorial concessions. Now it's looking increasingly like that would result in war, so better instead to advance a French candidate who is not the heir to the throne of France, who could then become a powerful ally of Louis XIV. And just to confirm this idea that Spain has you know, undergone a dramatic realignment from being an integral strategic part of the Habsburg Empire to being part of the extended French Empire, Louis XIV was not prepared to allow the Spanish to determine this issue on their own, and so he immediately sends troops into Milan, into Lombardy, and sets about on a series of major alliances in Germany to isolate the Austrians and prevent them fighting back. And France's crucial ally in this endeavor was Maximilian Emmanuel of Bavaria, the elector who I've just mentioned. And Maximilian of Bavaria has his own ambitions. He's not content to give up all of his ambitions because his son didn't become the compromised king of Spain. But as he is currently serving as the Spanish viceroy in the Spanish Netherlands, you're going to see this in the next episode. The Bavarians are trying to contrive a means of linking the western territories of the Habsburgs in Burgundy with their possessions, either, you know, in the other branch of the family in the Palatinate or with Bavaria, and creating some sort of grand network of Wittelsbach territories in western Germany and the left bank of the Rhine. So Maximilian Emmanuel of Bavaria is still incredibly ambitious, and he is going to pursue his interests on the side of the French. And just to point this out, at this time, the Wittelsbachs control the bishoprics of Cologne and Liège, again, crucial to French interests. And at the first point, so France is doing particularly well at this point in time. The Spanish succession seems to have, you know, gone perfectly. And in addition to that, Louis XIV seems that he has achieved not just the inheritance of Spain, but the inheritance of the entire Spanish Empire, which in addition to France is colored here in blue. And so now, buoyed by this lack of intervention or response from Europe's main powers, Louis goes a steps further and presses for the candidacy of the young pretender, so-called, the Stuart claimant to the throne of England, James III, over William III. So now he's getting involved in trying to bring back England into alignment with France in terms of this great reordering of the European order to suit France. Given that the French could now attack Holland because they had the control over major forts in the Spanish Netherlands and damage English trade, war between France and the Grand Alliance was now inevitable. The Grand Alliance involving England, the Netherlands, and the Austrian Empire. But now Louis wasn't nearly as apprehensive about the renewal of hostilities, since his position in 1701 was considerably stronger than that of 1697. Austria, for its part, was now set on maintaining its imperial interests, mainly focusing on Lombardy. Even though it's called the War of Spanish Succession, Archduke Charles wouldn't actually advance his cause for the throne of Spain until a major escalation of the conflict in 1703. Now, in terms of the course of the war, first of all, we start in Italy. And per the Treaty of London, Savoy, which is remembered as having fought against the French, actually begins the war by siding alongside the French, believing that in consolidating French control in Italy, Savoy will be rewarded with various territorial concessions. The Savoyards wanted control over Milan. They wanted to control Lombardy, and in return, they believe they would receive that territory, and they would have to give Nice and Savoy proper the Alpine regions, the French-speaking regions of the Duchy of Savoy, over to the French. Now, this is interesting because this is the exact same situation we see played out later during the Risorgimento, during the unification of Italy. And it's fair to say that Victor Amadeus II of Savoy was, again, this is a period of very ambitious rulers who want to make themselves kings. One of them is Frederick I of Prussia. One of them is Maximilian Emmanuel of Bavaria. And another one is Victor Amadeus II. And perhaps another one is also Augustus of Saxony. All of these lesser rulers trying to find a kingdom or find some way of elevating themselves. And whilst the Spanish have more or less been dominant in the north, Savoy has been this quiet power, this sleeping giant, which before now had just been the crossroads for invasion of the French and the Habsburgs into Italy. But now Savoy is trying to establish itself as a royal power, as a major power in the north. And in order to consolidate the position, it therefore falls naturally, if you see this little red area here in the north of Italy, to join with Lombardy and establish a major powerhouse in the north. And so, you know, at first, things go very badly for the French and the Savoyards. Eugene von Savoy, who is a Savoyard, but he's in the service of the Holy Roman Emperor, compels the French to various defeats at Carpi, at Cremona, and there is a major turning point at Lazara, during which, shortly after, Victor Amadeus II switches sides, believing that the stronger France's position is in this conflict, the less likelihood that he's going to acquire his ambitions by conquest. So he switches, and this proves in the short term to be a disastrous decision for the Savoyards, because the Savoyards are now occupied by France from 1703 until 1706 by French forces. Going now to the Netherlands, the imperial forces were unable to repel the French, who had occupied the country in 1701, and the Bavarians were now very close to linking up their territories with French territories in Trier and Landau, again pushing up on the left bank of the Rhine. And the intention of the French here in 1704 was to link up with the Bavarians and march on Vienna to force the Austrians out of the war. But this only results in the great Anglo-imperialist victory at Blenheim in 1704 under the Duke of Marlborough, the forerunner of the great Churchill family. And of course, he is assisted here by Eugene of Savoy. And the effect of this battle is to knock Bavaria out of the conflict, and Bavaria remains occupied for the remainder of the conflict. So France has now lost its greatest ally within the Holy Roman Empire. Meanwhile, Prussia, the new kingdom of Prussia, is no longer Brandenburg anymore. It's been elevated to the kingdom in Prussia. And Portugal have entered the conflict on the side of the imperialists. Blenheim was a decisive victory for the alliance, and Leopold had now died at this point in 1705, and he'd been replaced by his son Joseph. In 1706, Marlborough won the Battle of Ramillies, while Eugene won the Battle of Turin, making 1706 the annus mirabilis for the imperialists. Both the war in the Netherlands and Italy had been won for the alliance, reverting those territories to Habsburg control. Now, looking on to the main crux of the issue, which is actually the issue of the Spanish succession, the various kingdoms, we talk about the kingdoms of Castile and Aragon, were not unanimous in their support for Philip V Bourbon, and Catalonia and Valencia declared their support for the Archduke Charles, who personally launched a campaign from Lisbon with British support in 1704. And despite making impressive inroads early into the conflict, even reaching Madrid and Zaragoza, the capital of the ancient kingdom of Aragon, this is where we see a diversion of the interest between the British and the Habsburgs, because the British are mainly interested in controlling the Mediterranean Sea and becoming a major naval power. So they pick off Gibraltar. This is where Britain acquires Gibraltar, and they take off, establish a major naval base in Menorca. The British are able, therefore, to assist the Habsburg cause at sea and along the coastline. But any major campaign into the interior is always suffering from lack of resources. And it should be mentioned, outside of Catalonia, a serious lack of popular support, because Archduke Charles makes himself very unpopular very quickly. By 1706, the Grand Alliance, and the Grand Alliance, of course, being Austria, Britain, and Holland, it actually, England becomes Great Britain in 1707. So I'm using that term a little bit prematurely, but nevertheless, it does become Britain after this point. The Grand Alliance had achieved most of their objectives, but control over Spain, therefore, has remained elusive for the Alliance. Moreover, while France had retreated to her borders, she was capable of preventing invasion for the next 6 years. And this is due to the impressive Vauban fortifications that have been constructed by Louis XIV, which more or less guaranteed that any conflict involving France would actually happen beyond France's borders. In 1708, the Whig Party in Great Britain had produced a majority, and they were pushing for the idea that all it required was one great push in order for a total victory to be achieved through military means. And this is remarkable because despite a series of colossal famines in both Spain and France, which wipe out a significant section of the population, and the fact that France has been, you know, virtually, you know, in a constant state of war since the Spanish War of Devolution up until 1709, the Allies had seriously underestimated France's capacity to fight on. And in terms of their arrogance, the arrogance of the Grand Alliance, in the preliminaries of Hague in 1709, they essentially send France an ultimatum declaring that Archduke Charles is to be king of Spain and that Philip V has no choice but to quit Spain and leave the whole of the inheritance to the Archduke Charles. And of course, this delusion on part of the Grand Alliance over their desire to take over the entire Spanish inheritance is quickly dispelled with the Battle of Malplaquet in 1709, in which the French Marshal Villars successfully defends France from invasion led by the Duke of Marlborough and inflicts some 20,000 casualties on the Grand Alliance in a single day, making it one of the bloodiest battles in history up until that point, until we get to bloodier battles such as the Battle of Borodino in the Napoleonic period. And the same is sort of true for the situation of the Archduke Charles's forces in Spain. He's able to win a couple of victories, yet for every victory, the French Bourbon forces are able to inflict a defeat on Spain. And Charles V is unable to essentially create a popular movement behind him. The entire sort of support for his claim as King of Spain comes from the rebellious courts general of Aragon and from the British, who are, of course, using this conflict to sunder various territories away from the Spanish coastline, which is in turn making Charles incredibly unpopular. Now, 1711 is the great turning point in this conflict because Joseph, the Holy Roman Emperor, the elder brother of the Archduke Charles, dies. And this means that Charles is now the Holy Roman Emperor, and the British and the Dutch are now confronted with the exact same problem that they were trying to avoid, which is a universal empire under a single sovereign, a Catholic sovereign. So the reasoning for the British remaining in the conflict has now completely vanished, because the longer they are fighting for the cause of Charles, the more they are helping weaken the only power that can resist a universal monarchy and helping bring in that universal monarchy. So quite obviously, that same year, Queen Anne brings in a pro-peace Tory administration, which is now favouring this idea of ensuring that the French, actually, Philip, retains control of Spain. And the compromise would be this so-called Act of Succession, whereby France and Spain would be held by the same dynasty, the House of Bourbon, but that the thrones would remain separate forever. And the urgency of this, you know, it seemed, you know, the reason why Philip of Anjou had been selected was because it was very unlikely that he was going to inherit the throne. Yet the British and the French were very concerned, because this, of course, had major implications for France, that by 1712, in 1711, the Grand Dauphin dies, predeceases Louis XIV. In 1712, the so-called Petit Dauphin, the grandson of Louis XIV, dies as well, leaving the would-be Louis XV, his great-grandson and a two-year-old at this time, heir to the throne. And by French Salic law, the Duke of Anjou, who is now Philip V of Spain, is now heir to the throne of France. And of course, we're talking early modern sort of medicine. There is no guarantee that of course Louis the 14th is very advanced in years at this point. He's in his mid 70s, and should Louis the 15th inherit, there is no certainty that he's going to survive to his majority, in which case Philip the 5th of Spain would become King of France and unite the two thrones. So in order to prevent this, Salic law was actually amended by treaty with the English through the Act of Succession to ensure that France and Spain could never enter into a union. And once this was agreed, this became the basis of the Treaty of Utrecht, which created peace between England, the Netherlands, and France and Spain. And I think this is also significant in terms of inaugurating in the early sort of stages of that British maritime hegemony, which is going to be confirmed with the Seven Years' War. But again, this is less a conversation about Britain as it's much a conversation on France and the Habsburgs. Nova Scotia and Newfoundland is given over to Britain. And what is also remarkable is that despite being on the same side, this also sort of demarcates the point where the Netherlands is in decline relative to Britain. Britain becomes the main trading and maritime power and is concluding trade negotiations to benefit Britain at the expense of the Dutch. So a wedge has been placed in this alliance, which has been, you know, created by the Glorious Revolution in 1688, because it now seems that Britain is very much emerging as the major power, the senior power in both economic and military matters over the Netherlands. And to confirm their control over the Mediterranean, of course, the British have already taken territories in Gibraltar and Menorca. So it's almost universally considered, and this is why so much of our perspective on the Spanish War of Succession comes from the perspective of Britain, because this is seen as a vital stepping stone in terms of the creation of a unipolar British empire. Beginning in the 18th century, after coming out of a century where Britain was, you know, for the greater part of its history, nothing more than a secondary consideration, a junior partner of France. But since the Glorious Revolution and since the Spanish War of Succession, Britain has now emerged as the, it has united in 1707 to form Great Britain, and it has emerged as the great maritime power. And relative to that, all of the other nations in Europe are facing bankruptcy, whereas Britain comes out of this war wealthier than when it started. Now, the Austrians, quite understandably, are very pissed off about this, the fact that British have made a separate peace with the French, and the Austrians are still not relinquishing their claim to the entire Spanish inheritance. But of course, as British support of the Austrians was so crucial in maintaining any chance of Archduke Charles becoming King of Spain, in addition to Holy Roman Emperor, there was absolutely no chance of the Austrians winning this conflict against both France and Spain single-handedly. So the French actually began making gains right towards the end of the war in terms of, again, showing how enduring Louis XIV's institutions of France are, and France's ability to wage war. And so in the final year of his life, Louis XIV concludes the Treaty of Rastatt and the Treaty of Baden with Charles VI, now Charles VI, Holy Roman Emperor, he's no longer just Archduke Charles, which confirmed that many of Spain's imperial territories in Europe, save for Sicily, which would be given over to Savoy, would be transferred to Austria. And Austria would in turn recognize the Wittelsbachs back to Bavaria. So the Austrians have gained, certainly, from this conflict. They've gained control over the Habsburg, most of the Habsburg possessions in Italy, but they've had to concede Sicily to the Savoyards because, again, Victor Amadeus II wants to become a king. And taking over Sicily means, and transferring that sovereignty over to Savoy, there is an associated kingship with it. So he's very happy to get Sicily, even though there is no historical link between Sicily and the House of Savoy. Such a thing was a contrivance to give the Duke of Savoy the title of a king, as of course was one of the reasons why the Bavarians entered into this conflict as well, and why the Prussians entered into this conflict, so the Holy Roman Emperor could confer upon King Frederick the title of king in Prussia. There's another little element to it there. So what is left of the empire, the massive overseas empire, as we can see in this first image, including the Philippines and Spain itself, was left to Philip V of the House of Bourbon. and the disloyalty of Aragon, their allegiance to Charles V, was repaid with the Nueva Planta decrees in 1716, which abolished the separate kingdoms, for the first time making Spain, at least nominally, a unitary state. So when we talk about the unification of Spain, you can say it doesn't happen with the reigns of their most Catholic majesties in the late 15th century. Rather, it begins with the period of Bourbon rule in Spain, the end of the Habsburgs, with the Nueva Planta decrees in 1716, which created the basis for a unitary Spanish state. Now, a lot of commentators sort of end the conflict here or end the issue of the Spanish succession here. But I found, in my own sort of understanding and reading of this topic, that this is incredibly premature, because an aspect of the Spanish succession is, of course, this idea of the declining fortunes of the Habsburg monarchy. And even though France hasn't emerged out of this conflict, you know, in a glorious fashion, the Spanish War of Succession in many ways is a stalemate. And the actual sort of conclusion of the war represents many of those partition treaties, those compromise negotiations, such as the Treaty of Hague and the Treaty of London. But nevertheless, France gains Spain through Philip. And by that, I mean, don't mean France gains Spain, but the House of France gains Spain, the House of Bourbon, and with it, the Spanish Empire by extension. But again, nothing about this is clear. One of the remarkable facets is that France has not actually gained an ally from this, even though the uncle of the king, now Louis XIV, has finally died in 1715 and replaced by the child Louis XV. Even though the uncle of the king of France is on the throne of the Kingdom of Spain, Spain is in no way prepared to be an ally to France. What I'm going to do here with this idea of the Pacte de Famille is link this idea of Spanish decline and the French and the Spanish actually being of use to each other in terms of a familial alliance all the way until 1740, which will then be used as the step before we talk about Deutsches Dualismus, German dualism with the rise of Prussia and indeed other German powers, not just Prussia. Bavaria, of course, is a recurring nation. All of these discussions. Now, reiterating Rady's commentary, from now on, the Habsburg dominions were confined to their European possessions. Their empire of two worlds was at an end. Now, the Habsburgs were still a formidable force in 1714, undoubtedly the major European continental power, save for France, and they were capable of relaunching themselves, in my opinion at least, as a global power, were it not for the haphazardness, or rather, I would argue, the general incompetence of Emperor Charles VI and the necessities born of his pragmatic sanction. It is the loss of Spain and the effects of this pragmatic sanction in 1713. What the pragmatic sanction is, if you go back to my episode on the Habsburg monarchy, it is a legal mechanism to give the Habsburg domains, which are now left, in the Netherlands, in Italy, Bohemia, Hungary, Austria, etc., a sense of legal unity so they could be inherited through the female line. Charles VI was very insistent also that his daughter, Mary Theresa, would inherit, even though Joseph's daughters had a better claim than his own daughters. So not only did he want female succession, but he wanted his daughter, not the daughters of the previous emperor, to inherit, making the situation even more complicated. But the effect of the pragmatic sanction from a legal point of view was consolidating these Habsburg dominions into something which historians call the Habsburg monarchy. Now, it's important to note that this is a contrivance. This is a tool for ease of historical reference. But it's definitely something that the subjects of the House of Austria would not refer to. They would refer to themselves as subject of the respective domains they found themselves in. I am a subject of the King of Hungary. I am a subject of the King of Bohemia. I am a subject of the Lord of the Netherlands, etc., or the Duke of Milan. This idea that they were all part of an indivisible Habsburg monarchy was rather disastrous. But nevertheless, this reformation of the Habsburg dynasty into this idea of a Habsburg monarchy entails a huge amount of a short-term loss for the Habsburg dynasty. They've already lost Spain. They've already lost the Spanish Empire in the Americas. And they're going to lose even more territory throughout the unfortunate reign of Charles VI. Now, going back to what I mentioned briefly about this friction between the Spanish branch of Bourbon and the French branch of Bourbon, again, something which is often overlooked by chronicles of the War of the Spanish Succession, is the immediate aftermath, the incredible situation of the War of the Quadruple Alliance. Now, the Spanish were not content with this new position. As I alluded to earlier, whenever Charles II was presented with a will, he vetoed any attempt at partition. Rather, he believed the Spanish territories were indivisible. And the second wife of Philip V, Elizabeth Farnese, who, of course, was linked to one of the great reform-era popes, Paul III, and obviously the Duchy of Parma, which was the base of Farnese power in Italy, was incredibly ambitious to see the restoration of Spanish rule, if not in the Netherlands, then at least in Spain, which was her own sort of area of interest. And she, again, gives her husband, Philip V, who is very much under her sway. I mean, Philip V periodically has long periods, bouts of depression. At one point, I believe in 1724, Philip V abdicates in favor of his infant son, who duly dies, and in turn is restored to the throne. But Philip V was so under the influence of his second wife, Elizabeth Farnese, that he would actually live in the Queen's quarters, as scandalous as that was at the time. So essentially, for all intents and purposes, for the next 50 or so, from around the year 1714 until the year 1746, Elizabeth Farnese was really ruling Spain, with Philip II no more as her dupe. And she is the one who contrives this so-called War of the Quadruple Alliance, or what you can in fact argue is the War of French Succession, because in addition to Philip advocating for his dynastic rights, which had just been lost in the War of Spanish Succession, he was also advocating for his rights as heir to the French throne by right of Salic law. He believed that the Act of Settlement concluded with the British with the Treaty of Utrecht was an abomination. And therefore, if King Louis XV were to die, he desperately wanted to press his claim to the throne of France. So we live in this remarkable, have this remarkable and novel situation where the French and the British form an alliance against the Spanish. And not only that, but the French and the British are joined in that alliance by the Habsburgs and by the Dutch as well, who effectively become the underlings, the vassals of Britain at this point. And the reason the Habsburgs join is because they, of course, have taken over the vast possessions in Italy, in Naples, in Lombardy, in Sardinia, all of the territories which Elizabeth Farnese wishes to reconquer, meaning that she has inevitably brought herself in conflict with the Austrians. She believes at this point that because the Austrians are fighting another war, the Austro-Turkish War of 1716 to 1718, that they'll be far too distracted to actually hold on to their Italian possessions. And the Spanish can simply nip in, take over Sardinia, take over Sicily, which is now controlled by the House of Savoy, and take over Naples. Instead, we see the creation of the aforementioned Quadruple Alliance, and the Spanish can only, you know, resort to sort of sideshows like the supporting the Jacobite Rising of 1719, supporting the James III of the House of Stuart against now the Elector of Hanover, who has now come in as George I. Interestingly enough, it is now the French who are supporting the Elector, and they've already ditched their support for the Stuart claim as part of the Treaty of Utrecht as well. So it is actually the Spanish and not the French who are now supporting the Jacobite Wars in Britain. And of course, because the British are dominant at sea, the Austrians are supreme on the land, Philip is easily defeated within the course of 3 years, and he is forced in a humiliating position yet again to renounce his ambitions. And Elizabeth doesn't abandon these ambitions at all. Elizabeth Farnese instead transfers her ambitions to her sons. In particular, her son, Carlos Sebastian, who she makes as Duke of Parma in 1731. You know, but she of course is related to the Farnese branch. The Farnese branch dies out, so he is made Duke of Parma in 1731, and he is also established as the heir to the Grand Duchy of Tuscany, which is still being ruled by the Medici. In this case, under the childless Gian Gastone de' Medici, the last Grand Duke of Tuscany. So Elizabeth Farnese has hopes that in addition to her son controlling Parma, he will also control Tuscany. And what I mean by Elizabeth Farnese transferring her ambitions to her sons instead of Spain is that Elizabeth Farnese was the second wife of Philip. So Philip already had a Prince of Asturias. He already had an heir to the throne. So it wasn't anticipated at all that the would-be Charles III of Spain would become king. But nevertheless, he, you know, remarkably turns around the situation for the Bourbons, or rather the Spanish branch of Bourbons. And here we come to this idea of the Pacte de Famille, French foreign policy based on the alliances of the various branches of the House of Bourbons, because this short-lived alliance between Britain and France breaks down in 1731. Cardinal Fleury, the chief minister to Louis XV since 1726, had already begun to shift France's sympathies towards Spain. And the real turning point in terms of this rapprochement between the Spanish and the French branches of the House of Bourbon was that in 1729, Louis XV finally produces an heir, and that next year he produces a spare, Philippe of Anjou. Even though Philippe of Anjou will die later, that's beside the point. The point is now Philippe of Anjou is no longer heir to the French throne. He is so distant in the line of succession that his own claims to France, and therefore that vulnerability of France, the precariousness underpinning France's dynastic situation, was now gone, because Salic law had confirmed that the French branch of the dynasty would endure. So now France was finally in a position, some 20 years after the Treaty of Utrecht, to enjoy the fruits of winning Spain in the War of Spanish Succession. France no longer had any interest in propping up the various Habsburg treaty claims they had affirmed in the War of the Quadruple Alliance, which prevented the Spanish attacking Italy. And so after nearly 20 years of peace, and this is why Louis XV is called Louis the Beloved, because the first 20 years of his reign is heralded as this period of recovery and peace after the constant wars of Louis XIV. So with a strong and recuperated France intervenes in, well, it doesn't really matter what the issue is, the War of the Polish Succession. But just for the point of view of this conversation, the War of the Polish Succession is a means of France to weaken Austria. Austria is supporting one candidate. France is supporting the candidacy of the king's father-in-law, Stanislaus, whose name I can't possibly pronounce, because, again, my Polish is just as atrocious as my Spanish. And again, this all reflects on the ambitions of Spain as well. Elizabeth wants to expand, you know, her interests into Italy. And the effect of this idea of the Pacte de Famille is not just a notion, it is a formal contract in 1733, is that the French and the Spanish begin to conduct trading rights as well, which will give France a privileged position in the Spanish New World at a time also where the Spanish are embarking upon this redirection in the Spanish New World, this idea of mercantilism, because during the Habsburgs, so much of the wealth of the New World had essentially been redirected outside of the colonies and sent to the Netherlands. And so one of the great ambitions of the Bourbon monarchy in Spain was to create a single market, make the Spanish Empire an exclusive system of exploitation for the sake of the monarchy and not for the sake of individual merchants, let alone foreign powers. So all at this time, this is, you know, strengthening the position of Spain, but it's also strengthening the position of France. Now they are entered into this alliance. And with the background of this idea of the Polish War of Succession, Charles of Parma, the son of Elizabeth Farnese, finally has his opportunity to deal some serious damage to the Habsburgs, who have again taken over these territories in Italy. In 1734, he achieves his majority, and he declares his intention to liberate Naples and Sicily to relieve the kingdoms of the tyranny of the Austrian viceroy. And in an alliance with the Neapolitan and Sicilian nobility, Charles very successfully evicts the Austrians, declaring independence for what would later be referred to as the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies. Now, Charles would be the first sovereign king to rule from Naples since Frederick of Naples in 1501, and the first to rule over both Naples and Sicily from as a sovereign, ruling not as, you know, part of an extended empire like the Spanish Empire, since Charles of Anjou in the 13th century. And, you know, to compensate this, Charles VI has to give Parma to the Austrians, which creates the situation which will last for the next 100 years. Francis Stephen is given the rights which Charles III, later of Spain, had over Tuscany. And of course, that would later enter into the Habsburg dominion as well. So the Habsburgs re-establish and confirm their domination over northern Italy, whereas the House of Bourbon now controls France, and now controls Spain, and it now controls the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies. And of course, Charles would succeed his half-brother in 1759 as King Charles III of Spain. And the Neapolitan branch would remain a separate house, a branch of the Neapolitan dynasty. And under the influence of King Philip V of Spain and Charles III of Spain, both Madrid and Naples would imitate Versailles through the Royal Palace of Madrid and the Royal Palace of Caserta outside Naples, respectively. Both of these palaces are actually larger than Versailles in terms of the ambitions of the Spanish and the Neapolitan Bourbons, in terms of their imitation of their senior sort of branch back in France. Austria under Charles VI would continue to lose territory, not only to the Bourbons, but also to the Ottomans, for after having won so many victories against the Ottomans and temporarily holding Serbia, Bosnia, and parts of core Romania in Wallachia known as Oltenia, without Eugene of Savoy, the Austrians were decisively defeated by the Ottomans in 1739 and were forced to return all of these territories back to the Ottomans. So after almost 50 years of constant victories against the Ottomans from 1783, in 1739, Austrian expansion into the Balkans is for the first time seriously checked and reversed. And thereafter, the Austrians would consolidate around the Banat into the military frontier. And this would actually be the demarcation, more or less, for the Austrian territories, with a couple of minor exceptions, all the way up until the First World War, in terms of the effect of this defeat and the fact that the Austrians weren't able to continue to accrue more Ottoman territories. So just to summarize, to compensate for the loss of just one point before I come to summarizing. To compensate for the loss of a Habsburg overseas empire, so now that the Bourbons have taken over the Spanish overseas empire, Charles VI established the Ostend Company in the Habsburg Netherlands to compete for trade in the Indies with the British and the Dutch. And now, to the horror of the British, the company proved incredibly profitable through launching trade initiatives into China and benefiting from the trade of tea, the trade of silk, and the trade of porcelain. Porcelain is just skyrocketing in terms of popularity during this the inauguration of the Rococo period, and of course the Meissen porcelain factory in Saxony. And so within a few years, the company, which was only established in the early 1720s, had already established a series of competitive concessions to the East India Company, the British East India Company, and the Dutch VOC in India. And as part of this pragmatic sanction, this system by which Charles VI tried to recognize the succession of his daughter, Mary Theresa, he was compelled by his would-be allies, the British and the Dutch, who felt threatened by this new source of competition, to dissolve the company in 1731. And just to reference, this would really be the first and last attempt that Austria could have seriously launched some sort of major trading empire onto the world stage, because the Trieste Company, which was established some 50 years later, never goes anywhere and fails of its own accord, not needing the British and the Dutch to intervene. And the only sort of Habsburg territory, which we gained outside of Europe, is a tiny Chinese concession in Tianjin, modern day, I actually forget the modern day name of it in China, but it's the port connecting near Beijing. So this really is the end of the Habsburg hopes of any sort of revival at a global empire to compete with the Bourbons, having now acquired the Spanish concessions in the Americas. So having emerged victorious against the Ottomans and semi-victorious against France from the Habsburg possessions had retracted considerably in the 1730s. And by 1740, the empire was facing its own succession crisis of equal magnitude to Spain. The threat to Austria came again from France, who had benefited from such a drastic engorging of the Bourbons' dynastic possessions from 1701 to 1738. And with the Pacte de Famille, there was a semblance of an alliance between all of those parties, again, all at Habsburg expense. And to make matters worse, when we come to the year 1740 and the death of Charles VI and the ramifications of the Pragmatic Sanction, Austria will be faced by a new power, from a new and unanticipated source within the empire itself. And in order to find out what that is, even though I'm sure most of you will be aware of what I'm referring to, you'll have to watch the lecture this Saturday and the follow-up discussion on Monday, where we talk about German dualism coming after the War of Polish Succession. So there it is. I hope I've detailed the significance of this conflict and the dramatic diplomatic realignment against the Habsburgs, the unraveling of the Habsburg Empire from 1697 all the way up till 1740, and how France has been able to recover and achieve a position of near dominance in Western Europe. And their main, you know, colonial sort of maritime rival is now the British. And of course, France is going to be dealt a series of stinging defeats in as the chronology progresses. But for now, in 1740, things for France look pretty positive. There aren't the ill portents which are going to encompass the later reign of Louis XV and the entire reign of Louis XVI. But that's it in terms of the lecture. As I will put this little reminder up, now is your opportunity to ask me questions, unless anyone has sent me a super chat. But, you know, I will get your questions later, where I'll just read the super chat first. Steve Pierce for £20. Thank you very much, Steve Pierce. That's very generous. Thank you very much. Belated for the stream you did with Carl and Panama Hat. Absolutely fantastic discussion and a great compliment to the debate on AA stream. Bringing these ideas into the real world with historical examples is a revelation. Well, thank you very much, Steve Pierce. That really does mean a lot to me, and obviously pass those sentiments on to Carl Benjamin and Panama Hat. I was actually quite depressed by the AA stream. I almost thought it made elements of the discussion a bit redundant. Maybe I'm being a bit too harsh, but nevertheless, I mean, in terms of like bringing ideas into the real world with historical examples, I mean, what I found rather frustrating in terms of doing my own research, especially in terms of subjects which aren't pertaining to history, like political philosophy, is so much of history is, you know, the history of mind. It is the history of the reenactment of the thoughts of the people living in a particular time. It is a form of extreme tourism. In a sense, you're trying to get at the attitudes, you're trying to get at the everyday experiences or the psychology of people within those times. And so political philosophy and history, in terms of my understanding, go hand in hand. And therefore, I feel that using the actual sort of written sort of philosophies of someone like a John Locke or a Robert Filmer during the time, and you're trying to explain the context in which they're writing and the actual tangible real world effect of their writings, is essential in order to gain a deeper appreciation, not just of the political philosophy itself, but of the actual sort of real world ramifications of those ideas. So thank you very much. Right. Fitting for the stream, Med Colonials. Okay. Everyone was depressed by the AA stream. Maybe I need to listen to it. I mean, I got in, I watched it for about half an hour, then I came back to it for about another half an hour. But I feel there's a lot of sort of talking across purposes, which is unfortunate. Well, such is the sort of manner of, having a some form of debate, as opposed to a discussion. Obviously, I don't find such a manner conducive towards, getting across ideas or helping, facilitate discussions. So that's unfortunate. But again, I don't mean to be too harsh on that stream. But I did feel a little depressed watching it. Sorry, I'll just go back and find if there was, because there hasn't been a flurry of questions. Oh, and I do apologize if this stream has been a bit details heavy. I mean, in terms of my sort of understanding of this period, I often find that just the focus on the one war, like the War of the Spanish Succession, without putting things into its broader context in terms of the overall sort of broader implications and ramifications, has very much confused my understanding of this period for a very long time. And I feel that you can't understand the War of Spanish Succession without linking it tangentially to the War of Austrian Succession and the events which lead from 1701 to 1713 and 1713 to 1740. But the effects of this also are that this is very much like a diplomatic focus history, and we're of course focusing on the history of Spain, because Spain looms so large in the histories of Europe in the 16th and the 17th century as the center of Habsburg authority, both military authority and economic might within Europe, that one can't really speak of the history of France, the history of the history of the Netherlands, the history of Germany, and the history of Italy without talking about Spain. Not the least because the Spanish indirectly controlled a vast amount of those territories as well. And of course, all of this links into the strategy of empire within the Austrian half of the Habsburg dominions. So yes, it's important to understand the revelation in terms of the Austrians losing their global empire component in the form of the Spanish Empire, and what are going to be the long-term implications of that when we get to 1740, and what looks like at the early reign of Mary Theresa and her husband Francis Stephen, not just the withdrawal of so much in terms of Habsburg authority, the decline of Habsburg authority, the loss of territory to be gained by the French. But it looked at one point as if the Spanish, sorry, the Austrians would lose, the Habsburg dynasty would collapse entirely during the Austrian War of Succession. Right. Terry Steely for £5. Thank you very much, AM. Well, thank you very much. I'm just, it's unfortunate that no one can ask me a question because I am available to answer questions, but nevertheless, thank you very much. That is very much appreciated. Jayasuran Goral Manyan says, Apostolic Majesty, after this period, what changes do Habsburgs implement to consolidate their rule in future Austria, in the future Austrian Empire? And are there writings on its relation to the old ideas of Dominus Mundi? I'm going to answer one part of that because, in terms of, I've already gone over Camerlissimus in the stream I did a while ago on the Habsburg monarchy, and as is the nature of Nations of Charlemagne, I'll be focusing less on Austria itself than on its relationship with the other German powers as we move away from Austria and towards German unification in the 19th century. So do check that out. In terms of the ideas of Dominus Mundi, well, what is remarkable is that we start off this period during the reign of Philip IV with Campanella talking about the Spanish as being the natural vehicles for a Dominum Mundi, taking this idea which had been reiterated by the Marches di Gattinara during the reign of Charles V. And invariably, the Spanish had not only pressed their claims to, restoring parts of the territory lost to France, but also pressed their claims over their Austrian counterparts. At one point, I believe it was Philip III, pressed the Spanish claim to Hungary and Bohemia during the so-called Brotherly Quarrel, when Rudolf and Matthias and Ferdinand II were fighting over the fate of the what would later become the Habsburg monarchy. But in terms of the Dominus Mundi idea, the idea of a world, a monarchy, from the Habsburg point of view, that is very much dead at this point. We have a Catholic empire, a titular Catholic emperor, and his territories are going to endure and reconsolidate and reform throughout the entirety of the 18th and the 19th centuries. But the idea that the emperor can actually, have any sort of tangible temporal domination of the world, compared to that of Charles V, is completely gone. In terms of like what happened with France, I've always contended that, especially from the period around 1680, that had Louis XIV been able to realize it, he would have made himself Holy Roman Emperor either by conquest or compelling the electors to vote for him after the death of Leopold, and he would have attempted to very much lean into this idea of Dominus Mundi. And let us not also forget that Campanella was brought in as an early tutor of Louis XIV, even though he wouldn't have left really any impression on him because he died far too early. But the ideas of redirecting this Dominus Mundi, Domino Mundi, from Spain to France was actively pioneered by Campanella during the 1640s. But of course, France didn't really have the ability to realize that. And what sets Louis XV apart from Louis XIV is that Louis XV was far less able, far less competent, far less imaginative, and he squandered an incredibly advantageous position, to put it bluntly. So even with the consolidation of the three Bourbon dynasties in Naples, in Spain, and in France that we're seeing, with my demarcation point at 1738 to 1740, it would appear that France is in a very strong position compared to where they started, which is also why I wanted to do this in a separate stream as opposed to an addendum to my previous stream on French absolutism. It's going to be a very much fleeting victory for the French, and the French are not going to be able to make do or consolidate this victory into anything tangible. Rather, it's going to be decline compounding other declines. So there we are, or defeat rather. Right. Apostolic Majesty from MN Universal. Can you talk about the changes the Bourbons implemented in the Spanish Americas? Sorry if I already talked about it. I would, but unfortunately, I don't know enough about it for this stream. Other than talking about the broad implications of taking the Spanish monarchy before under the Habsburgs, which was relatively free trade, in the fact that Germans and the Dutch were able to come and go, and that the French wanted to consolidate it into something resembling a protected market, a mercantilist market, following in the absolutist example of France. In terms of going into the specifics, I have been petitioned to to do another series on Spanish history, and if I were to do a series on Spanish history at some point in the distant future, it would inevitably have to involve the Americas as well, because they are so interrelated. In the same way that if I were to do a topic involving Britain, it would inevitably have to involve the Dominions and America if I'm going into the 18th and the 19th century, or even the 17th century. So yes, other than that, that seems to be the end of the questions. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. Thank you for the super chatters. For the super chats, thank you to the super chatters. And remember to tune in on Friday. We're going to be discussing Tolkien again. It's provisionally called Tolkien's Paradise Lost. We'll be focusing on the first nine chapters of the Silmarillion. Oh, Bolero just sent a super sticker for $5. Bolero393. Thank you very much. That's very much appreciated. Anyway, thank you all and good night.